Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everyone. This is another recording for the Sex Work and Sexualities channel of the New Book Network. My name is Rachel Stewart. I'm a PhD researcher at the University of Kent, and I am talking to Francine Tremblay about her book, Organizing Sex Workers' Rights in Montreal. Francine, can you tell us who you are and about your background and the book?
Ah, all right. So, yes, I'm from Montreal, and I wrote this book following my dissertation, which I defended in 2012. But let me go back to when I started in the industry, because I think it's extremely important that we put that book in context and everything that I have done so far within the academia. I started in the industry in 69. I was 17 years old. I left in 1988. The main reason I left was, I think, that after almost 20 years, I wanted to do something else. And the industry was changing rapidly. And I was not at a very good place where I was working at the time. So I decided to leave, but I left, I think, a bit too soon, and I was totally unprepared. I left, I had a BA already. I had a BA in psychology. So I was, at one point, I went back to university, got a BA, and here I am. I left, and big mistake, because I couldn't find work. And I was a bit of a pain in the butt. I was an activist always. So the moment I left the industry, of course, no one wanted me back. They were kind of happy I was gone. So I had to find something to do, and then I opened my own company, a computer company. So I had the company for 5 years. And then I decided to go back and go back at university, Concordia in Montreal. And I did I came back to do a certificate on family life education and to run workshops. Well, that was a year and a half, and that was only a certificate, and I ended up with a PhD. So, in 1999, Franz Shaver, who was teaching, she retired since then, was teaching at Concordia, and Franz Shaver is, along with a few others that I will name later, is the pioneer on sex work in Canada. She has been doing sex work forever, sex work research forever. At that point, so I met her in the Department of Sociology, and she mentioned a group called Stella. This is 1999, and I'm going, okay, what is sex workers? First of all, sex workers. What is a sex worker? Then Fran and I sat down, and of course I told her that, you know, I had been in the business. And this is when we started a friendship, support, and really the journey. She was with me the entire journey. So this is when I joined Stella as a just volunteer work at Stella. And this is 99. And then I finished my MA in 2000, which was on identity, totally theoretical. And then somebody suggested, my director at the end said, well, you should do a PhD. You should go on to the PhD. And he knew my interest was identity and social movement.
Okay.
And of course, Stella, a group of sex workers by and for. And the thing that was amazing, Rachel, is the appellation was the name, sex worker. Okay, so then I guess I'm a sex worker. You know, it's like I actually have a term. I have an expression. I have a word that belongs to me. I mean,
It's so funny you should say that, because I've been having this conversation with people a lot recently. And for anyone listening, like the phrase sex worker is generally used in preference to the word prostitute. Okay. And I have no problem with the word prostitute. But I don't think sex worker really kind of captures what it is that we do, because the work sounds like a laboring, and I was never a laborer. Right? The work doesn't capture the hustle that's involved. So I'm tending to favor sexual commerce nowadays.
Oh, okay. Sexual commerce. Okay. Yes.
That's just my own personal opinion, but I get totally what you're saying about, you know, being able to identify with a phrase that fits what you're doing.
And it works in English, but in French, it makes almost grammatically and just as a concept, it's more difficult in French than in English.
Okay.
And Carol Lee was quite right when she coined the expression to focus on the work part of it.
Yeah.
I'm working. And for me, Rachel, it was easy because in 69, and even, I mean, I was the baby in the industry. Every woman around me was a lot older than me. But we punch our cards, and there, I went to work. It was very easy for me to grab the word and adopt it because I was working.
Yeah. And it's funny because when I was reading your book earlier on, and I've literally just come off the beach, people have been reading it on the beach. I read what you said. You quoted Jo Phoenix, and I've met Jo a couple of times. She's lovely. And she talks about, like, the biggest fear for sex workers is being discovered.
Yeah.
And I would say, actually, I would say that's your second biggest fear. Your first biggest fear is not making any money. Yeah, because
100%.
Because this is an economic activity.
It is, yes.
Once you've made your money, and it's by virtue, it's precarious. So not making any money that day is an issue. That's more worrying. Once you've got your money in your purse, then you can worry about being
banned. Then you can worry about something else. It's your livelihood.
Yeah. And I think that sometimes it's that type of stuff that people who, you know, well-meaning sort of researchers who don't have lived experience don't understand. There's worse things than being caught out someone selling sex. The worst thing is not selling sex.
Not being able to make a living out of it, not being able to actually, pay your rent and be independent.
Yeah.
You're It's your livelihood. It's as simple as that. You're working.
Yeah. I don't think I've ever seen any of the academic literature talk about the anxiety or that feeling that you get if you don't make any money. You know?
No, they don't.
No, because, you know, there's so few of us with actual lived experience. So how did you come to write this book then? Because it's an awesome book.
So at the end of the defense, which was not an easy, there was a lot of controversy around my analysis. And finally, I ended up the book. I'm so happy because finally the dissertation was never published at UCAM where I defended it. So, but they all, Colette Parent, Fran Shaver, and Cecilia Benoit, Chris Brockett, who are researchers in Canada, they told me that, you know, it would be great if you would transform this into a book. In order to survive, especially in, you know, like almost, 15 years ago, I had to teach a lot at Concordia. So it gave me really little time to actually write, okay, to actually change it, transform this into, a book. So I guess you know that in Canada, Stella and Canadian sex workers organization finally made it to the Supreme Court and won at the Supreme Court. And we won the fact that it would decriminalize sex work, decriminalize especially prostitution, which is always the problem. It's always what people are, they get excited about. To finally, after 1 year, so we finally won. And then 1 year after, and I think the book explained this pretty well, a year after, in 2014, or 2015, I have to verify the dates, it was overturned and to have what we call the Bill C-36. Right. And this bill now is, I keep forgetting, I have a mental block, is Protection of Neighborhood and the Exploited Person Act. So this was by Peter McKay, who was at the Justice Minister, Conservative government, and everything we worked for at least 10 years, all the effort, were, for me, went down the drain, because it made sex work, it made the industry even more dangerous. I remember I was in Halifax in Canada and I decided to write the book. And this is when I start, so we're around 2015. I rewrote the book three times, send it to publisher. It was not working. And I know it was not good enough. And I know that, but nobody believed that I could actually turn it into a book. They said it was too much work, which was, I thought that you don't know me. To finally have this person at Lexington accepting the book. We met at Fran. We didn't meet. She emailed me and she reached out during, I was celebrating Fran Shaver's retirement. She wanted to meet. We finally did not meet in person, but we exchanged email and she said, send me your proposal. And I think it's Emily. It's at the beginning in the acknowledgement. Her name is there. And I send her the proposal, and she accepted immediately.
Do you think that what you've encountered there is a kind of one of the extra kind of layers of marginalization that sex work research, sex work academics who've had a history of sex work experience. It's almost like our academia gets underestimated because of our sex work. I mean, for me personally, I submitted an abstract for a chapter a few weeks ago with some very well-known academics in the sex work research field. And they refused my abstract and asked me if I wanted to write a 1,200-word essay instead. And I was like, nah, don't think so.
And what was the reason?
Titillation, I should imagine. But I think I think that's what happens, doesn't it? That's what happens in our field. We face an extra layer of discrimination that's never talked about.
And I agree with you on that. It's they want us to write about victims. They want us to write about sexuality. They're not. It's like they want to appear like as a scholar. I don't know how to say. It's like they want to hear about victims. They want to hear about trafficking. They want to hear about sex, like the one that you read on the research, the paper, okay, the article that, thank God, Cecilia Benoit offered me the chance to write this for a special edition. One of the reviewer asked me to get into the sex war. And I said, no, this is done. What do you want me to say about the sex war?
Yeah, it's done to death. We've moved on.
It's done. I want to talk about work, about labor. I want to talk about labor's right. I want to talk about safety and right that comes with labor's right. I don't mind if another person wants to get into sexuality. By all means, no, I can write about sexuality tomorrow. But this is not what the article was about. And if you see the last, if you look at the last chapter of the book, this is how I end. Enough about sexuality. If I can write about sexuality, but this is not where I'm at now.
Yeah. And I think that's really important as well, because when I was reading this, it made me think of Beloso, Brooke Beloso, and what she talks about is this really unhealthy fixation on sexuality and gender studies that distracts from sex work as a topic of work. And I think that's really important, because what I perceive, and I don't know if you agree with this, is that there's actually a fetishization of the relationship between a sex worker and her client, to the exclusion almost everything else that's going on in her life. And actually, non-sex working academics don't tend to sort of like understand that actually the punters are really not that important. If you're not getting them and you're not making any money, then they become important. But they're really the backdrop to everything else. And what we need is more, I think, more literature about the engagement with third party relationships, the engagement, you know, and the normal day-to-day stuff about people picking the kids up from school and stuff like that. That's what we need. We need to stop focusing on the sex work and and start talking about sex work as a form of precarious labor, because that's what it is. We need to, you know, and from my understanding and what you pick up in the book, is the 1860s basically pushed sex workers away from the main body of the working class, yeah, and has kept them there all this time by focusing on their relationship with the client. You know, it would be like talking to plumbers and only focusing on, you know, like the actual kind of putting in a toilet, yeah, and not talking about anything else, you know, and meanwhile marginalizing them for that. And you know, that's what I really got from your book as well, this kind of slight sense of exasperation. Say, look, people, this is work.
Yeah, and I think you answered the question that you asked me before, you know, about publishing. It's like they want us to talk about everything except work. Except that I have no children. I never had any desire to have children. But I'm very aware that so many sex workers, so many people, so many women in the industry have children. They have so much outside of, you know, being in the industry, but only in the industry are people focusing on what they're doing, on their work, about sexuality. And instead of, yes, they have a life outside, you know, like, let's talk about what you just mentioned about their family, their life, their children.
Yeah.
You know,
but I think that's the insider outside dichotomy though, isn't it? It's because what we tend to get in the literature is the stuff that can be observed. So to an extent, you can observe certain aspects of sex workers' lives. You can observe them stood on the street. You can observe online forums. You can observe people webcoming. So you can make extrapolations from those observations. But that can be really damaging. And that what actually needs to happen is that the discussion has to go back to the sex worker to actually kind of talk about what they, you know, about their actual experience.
And on this note, most probably the last paper, the article you read, will most probably be the last one I will write at this level, like interviewing. I'm not on the field anymore, you know. I'm more a theoretician when it comes to, identity. I think I feel like going back to identity, marginalized identity. And the reason I'm saying this is because I think that I'm moving further and further away from the reality of sex workers. And I know that my good friend was, I don't think she was impressed with the article. And the reason why, it's because, you know, everything we write, everything we say, prohibitionists are like, you know, vultures. They're just looking. And you know, one sentence, one thing I say, one thing I write will end up being twisted and may damage the movement. And like I told her, I said, I cannot carry this kind of responsibility. Not in Montreal. Okay, I don't know in other countries, but I know that in Montreal, we're such a small little community. You know, Montreal is almost like a big village compared to main cities. But no, I agree with you. I definitely will take some recommendation or some ideas from others in order to pursue writing.
Yeah. And it's quite interesting that you talk about identity and your desire to kind of like explore more identity, because I really liked what your book discussed about the horse symbol. So can you tell us how the book discusses that?
Okay. First of all, anyone who knows me knows that I will argue until you just throw a book at me and throw me out of a room. And, you know, in Canada, we had three majors commission that cost taxpayer a fortune. And every time at the end, no matter what, the laws are just getting worse. They're not helping. They're, you know, hurting woman autonomy, endangering woman's life. And I'm saying, why is it after hundreds of years, at least 120 years since 1880, since 1860s, that we have these conversations over and over again? And in Canada, at least 45 years. And we cannot undo this link between, and this is my argument, we cannot undo the link between drugs. It used to be syphilis, now it's HIV, and criminal and trafficking. We cannot undo what, according to my research and my argument, whatever was created in 1850, 1880, is very much alive. The context may be different, but it sticks to us. Sex workers, first of all, there's no such a thing as sex work. It's immoral, dangerous, only desperate women would enter the industry. Organized crime is, manage the industry. We cannot undo. It is glued to us as sex workers. Drug, venereal disease or HIV, and trafficking. That was my argument. That is from beginning to end. That was my point of departure, was the whore symbol. Because what's her name? The prostitution prison, Gail Peterson. She introduced the whore stigma, but she never recalled the history behind it. And I know that some people, when I was writing the book, I know that one of the reviewers say, why do you, we don't need that part. And I insisted, because the book is not for academics. The book is for the general public.
Yeah, yeah. And I don't think the general public necessarily, are sort of privy to the sort of debates that we're privy to, maybe, especially around things like the conflation of like sex work with trafficking. You know, that's become so insidious that it's virtually impossible to have a conversation nowadays about any form of sex work without mentioning the T words. You know, I absolutely refuse to engage with it. Yeah, not having it, because it's spurious. You know, but I think it's this, and I don't know if you agree with this, but it's almost like this. It's that the most disadvantaged of the sex working field, because there are women on the street. I do street interviews. I do street outreach. The most disadvantaged, disenfranchised women are used by political actors in order to push through an agenda that controls the economic activities of those of us who are better able to stay away from the law. You know, it's proximity to the law, and it works very well to keep some people close to the law, because you can carry on legislating against sex work based on these, the most disadvantaged. And I speak from experience of just being part of two researches, and we found that policing, heavy policing attached to the Nordic model, increases violence, yeah, that women experience. We've got the proof. We've got the evidence. We did quants. We gave them what they wanted. They want figures, we'll give them to you. But we're still hearing these same tired old arguments, because actually people make political mileage. It's like political clickbait.
I agree with you on that. And I have to, it just reminds me, I teach a course at Concordia because, you know, thank God for Fran Shaver, because she actually put it in the curriculum at the industriology department. There is a group, there's a video, recent video on YouTube that comes from prohibitionists in Canada. Okay, so there's four main women on that video, and especially one of them has been with prohibitionists, and of course, you know, like equating sex work with trafficking and you know, rape and torture and drugs and victimization. And I showed this video in class, and I looked at it, and of course she was crying, and I looked at it and I said, they are exploiting this woman in order to make a point. Now, I'm sorry, but you prohibitionists are exploiting women's pain, and they make sure they stay in pain. They make sure they relive whatever happened to them at that time. That was such a realization for me. And this was just now. This is the session that I just ended. And I will definitely work on this more, because I will be teaching the course again.
Yeah.
But I mean, I have to show you. I will send you this. Please.
And for anyone listening, the article that Francine has written, I will include it in the blog that goes with this, so they can access the article as well. But yeah, I hear you. And it's almost, I always get the impression like this, like most sex workers, you don't know they're sex workers. You're never going to find them unless you happen to come across them online. Yeah, they're nowhere near any of these prohibitionists. I always imagine like one woman stood on the street surrounded by social workers, prohibitionists, police, whilst everyone else is making money. Yeah. Like sex workers left the building 100 years ago. And that's the issue. This is the issue, is that they can't access people that they can't access without the use of a gatekeeper.
Yeah, exactly.
What's the gatekeepers? It's always the criminal justice system. Yeah, it's always a criminal. The gatekeepers always come through the criminal justice system. So who are they engaging with? Women that are engaged with the criminal justice system. And they use that to kind of like, you know, as an example of where the industry is at. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just exploitation. It's actually a form of, I feel like it's a form of colonization. You know, they take people's narratives and use it for their own, you know.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And they use, I think when I was looking at this, at the video, was like, wow, they're, and she's not, the person is not getting any better. It makes no sense. They're actually filming, using, exploiting this person's pain to make a point. I mean, this is indecent. This for me is, you know what, unethical. And it's like, and you're talking, not that I want to relativize, but it's like, this is for me unacceptable. And on that note, this is here is my point that sometimes I get into trouble. One thing I always said, I never hid the fact that I don't think that everyone is able to enter the industry and be comfortable in it and, you know, be able to work in it and function in it. Some women, if you need to constantly be under the influence in order to work, first of all, it's dangerous to you. But I think you have to rethink your decision to be in the industry. And my problem right now in Canada, at least, is there's nothing that will really help women who wants to stop, who wants to transition from the industry to another form of work. there's nothing for them except, you know, welfare.
Yeah, you've got to hustle out of hustling. You have to get a side hustle to hustle out of hustling, because the money is so good and the hours are so short that you're not going to go back to working 8 hours a day for 5 days a week to earn a fraction of what you were earning before. You've actually got to start thinking about it before you leave. And this is why, you know, like sort of the organizations Stella are really important, because it's that type of discussion that sex workers need to have with each other. And that's why organizations like Stella are so important, you know, because also as well, I mean, you know, we need to start talking about, okay, so you might want to stop selling in-person sex work, but there's other ways you can do it that you might be able to do working around what you're doing. You know, we need to be introduced. And that's why you need organizations like Stella that this book talks about so lovingly. Yeah, I can really feel the love that you've got for this organization, because we need, you know, let me say, we need the wisdom of horse. Yeah, we need to tell each other what time it is. You know, I, some of the most amazing people that I know are sex workers. Yeah, they're smart and innovative, and you know, we need to share that wisdom with each other, because nobody else is going to give it to us. Nobody else is going to give it to us. So we need to do that, and that's why, you know, the work that Stella does, and your book describes Stella beautifully.
Yes. Yeah, that I have.
You can feel the love that you have for this organization coming through the pages. And you, what really struck me is the pain that you feel around the failures. Can you tell us about the pilot project? What happened with that?
My God. This, there was a pilot project. That project was to decriminalize a zone, okay? And there was so much faith in that project. There was so much expectation. That means that around a table for many years was police, sex workers, activists, many community organization in Montreal. There was a round table. And after years of discussion, finally, someone came up with an idea to have this pilot project to decriminalize a certain area in Montreal where there wouldn't be any arrest. Okay. So hopefully, my recollection, but it's very, it's well described in the book. And so, but it was misunderstood by the neighbors. Okay, so it was in a certain neighborhood in Montreal that this area would be decriminalized. So everything is in place. Everybody saw the paper. Everybody saw the plan. Those around the table, and of course the neighborhood representation. So they have this huge meeting in a local, in a venue in the neighborhood. Well, first mistake. The project was introduced by a French person, a French from France. Okay. Now you have to understand, this neighborhood is there's a lot of poverty. People are struggling. It is a well-known neighborhood in Montreal where there's a lot of petty crime, or you know, and they introduced that project in that neighborhood by a French person from France. Well, of course, it took. Apparently, I was at Stella at the time, but I was not at these meetings. It took a few minutes for people starting to insult, scream. It turned into total chaos. The neighbors, people that were there, apparently there was about 300 people. People there starting to say, not in my neighborhood, you will not you know, we have enough trouble here that you will not, you know, convert my neighborhood into a giant brothel. And the main problem they had, they said they were not consulted. They were consulted. So it turned into a total nightmare. But what is so sad about this project, there was so much work done. Sex workers participated, they talked, they came to an understanding that they had to find a solution. And they're already bylaws. Like, give you an example, like, no, you cannot scream your head off in the middle of the night. You cannot, exchange, have sex act, give blowjobs in an alley in where people go by. You know, there was a lot of this, discussion. And I think it was an excellent project that could have finally tried to find a solution to this constant fight between neighbors, residents, and sex workers. And of course, you know where I'm going with this, street-based sex work. Because this is the only thing that bothers people in Montreal. Let's be very clear. Is street-based sex work. Back then, now everything seems to bother them, but back then it was street sex work. This project for me was so interesting, but once I interviewed for the actual dissertation, I realized that the head of the table, the main person responsible for that project, really what they wanted was an exit. They wanted Stella to be an exit organization. And I don't think they were very transparent on that. I don't think they were clear enough on that.
No. Then it's funny, isn't it? Because what you're talking about is the visibility of sex workers.
The visibility of sex work.
So that kind of argument, that prohibitionist argument, follows sex workers. So it's followed them online to an extent. Okay, but I always think it shows how disingenuous, and this kind of breaks my heart actually, because a lot of this prohibitionist is feminist based rhetoric. Yeah. And what happens is then, and I've seen that in my own research with webcamming. So webcamming, practically every single webcam transaction goes through the banking system. Yeah. All right. Practically everyone. Where is the prohibitionist? Where are they? You know, but if it's visible in some way, if it's like Backpage or somebody on the street, they will have come for sex workers. If a multi-million dollar industry like the banking system is profiting from a form of sex work, they don't say anything, you know. So the closer to the law that you are, the heavier that this carceral type of feminism comes for you, you know. And it's so disingenuous. It's so disingenuous.
And remember, Rachel, that in Canada, I don't know how it is elsewhere, but most prohibitionists, well, the grand priestess of prohibitionists in North America is Catherine McKinnon. They're all lawyers. And this is what makes it so difficult to get head and head with them. Is because of their legal argument. Not that it cannot be undone, far from it. But what makes it very difficult to tackle is because they use the law. And what hurts so much is that they're women. They look like me. And many of them went through the same struggle that we went through as women. And they, you know, the article, that was not the title of the last article. The title was, "If you ask me a question, listen to my answer and believe me." That was the genuine title. And whoops, I just forgot. I forgot to plug my, that was the genuine title. What hurts the most is the only thing they will actually believe is if I'm a victim. They will not believe anything else.
No, but also as well, they're kind of like their total failure to recognize that this actually creates, that this dance creates victims. You know, we're going to have to take from them. They're never going to give us anything. They're never going to give us anything. But luckily, some of us are undercover. We might look like them, but outlaws, really.
We won't give up. I mean, yeah, that's for sure. I mean, we won't give up.
And just for the record, I have a law master's. I can fight.
All right. You go.
Yeah. So what did you learn while writing the book?
Oh, boy. What did I learn? Oh, my God. First of all, this book is a collaboration between Jen Clayman and myself. I think, you know, Jen and I had so many conversations, and we agreed, disagree, and at one point we came to an agreement, and I said, okay, you give me the information, you choose, because don't forget, I mean, the dissertation was like 200, close to 300 pages.
And for the listeners, can you tell us who Jen is?
Oh, Jen Clayman is communication at Stella. Okay. And she's still there. As we speak, Jen is still responsible for communication at Stella. When I met her, as a matter of fact, she just came back. I met her in 99. Or 2000, and she was just back from the UK. She is an international activist, and she has been at Stella and with me since, you know, the very beginning. We're very good friends, and we had so many conversation and debate on, you know, during the dissertation and during that, you know, writing that book. And even before we started, we said, okay, here's the agreement. You're responsible for the information, what we will say in that book, and I'm responsible for the analysis. Everything else went pretty well after that, but it was... I learned that writing about sex work is going to a minefield. And I think I said it at the very beginning. When you write about sex work, somebody will get hurt. Someone will get hurt. Someone will not like what I write. So a prohibitionist will just wait for me to make a mistake, say something that I'm not supposed to say, write something that I'm not supposed to write. And then you have sex workers that will say, well, this is not my experience at all. I learned writing this book that is dangerous writing. Contrary to, because I intend to transform my master into a book, which is on identity, which is totally theoretical. While writing the book and writing the article, even in the article, if you note, there is a at the end, I'm very clear. What is it? Disclaimer. No sex workers organization participated in me writing this article. I am totally responsible for it. I learned how difficult it was to write a book that recalls the life, the existence, the organization of marginalized and criminalized women.
Yeah. And that's funny you should say that, because I mentioned earlier on somebody asked me to write a 1,200 word essay. This is 2 weeks ago. I'm still livid. Yeah. But when I responded to them, I said, you know, like 1,200 words, like I've had many entries and exits from sex work. Yeah. I've worked every decade since the 80s, not consistently, you know, but I've dipped in and out. You know, so which one of my experiences do you want me to write about? And if I only write about one, I'm going to damage us, which is why I refuse to write, because it would damage the sex working population. Because actually, I was exploited as a teenager. So if I write about that, I go straight into this debate around exploitation. If I write about the time my webcam so I could take my millionaire ex-husband to court to get more maintenance, well, then that makes me look privileged and, you know. So any one of those could be damaging, and all the other stuff that I've done in between could be damaging, you know. But it's that sort of stuff that we need to be so careful about. It's like, you know, every single experience of sex work is different for every single woman and every single person, not just women, because a lot of other people involved in sex work, you know. And I think that's what we have to do. Not one voice represents everyone. And, you know, would any other type of precarious labor be expected to represent everyone? Would one, I don't know, like, would one sort of like market trader's experience be expected to replicate all forms of market trade? Would one cleaner be expected to represent all cleaners? No, of course not. It's not realistic. And that's the issue, isn't it? That's the reductionism that we face. We reduce people's experience to the most heinous, you know, and then we legislate it, and that's not on. But I think it's quite funny as well, because I think what's happening here, and I kind of, you write about this a lot, because you write really nicely about the landscape, the physical and historical landscape of Montreal, and you use the sort of campaigning that went on there to compare it with the British system. And basically, what you talk about is the legislation against prostitution at a point where we're entering heavy industrialization, and when sort of like and how sort of like, you know, sort of like basically that there's an attack at that same time by the middle classes against sex workers. And I'm really interested in how that narrative changes now that we're not heavily industrialized. Now more and more middle-class women, you know, technically middle-class women, are having to be involved in sex work, because actually you can't make money. You know, when I interviewed 35 webcam performers about their experiences of like webcamming, over half of them had degrees. Mm-hmm. They couldn't get jobs.
They couldn't get jobs.
And that is what I really like about your book, is because the book puts Montreal into context. It puts Montreal into context. You know, the sex working experience there, it puts it in an international perspective. It brings up the debates that, as sex working researchers, we're all very familiar with, but introduces them in a way that's kind of like digestible. Like I said, I read the book on the beach earlier. It was a pleasure to read. And I just felt that it was a really good crossover book for, you know, you made your point as a sort of sex worker. It was readable for an academic. It's readable for people who aren't academics. And it gets the types of stuff that us as sex worker researchers are very familiar with, that maybe the general public is not so familiar with. The conflation with trafficking and how that replicates the white slave trade debate of like 100 years ago.
They get hysterical around this. It drives, okay, and by the way, what is interesting is they, and Guilford, who's an historian, And I just love to mention him because he's the one who argued that the so-called pimp, this criminal, came in our life as sex worker after she was thrown out of the neighborhood, after this woman found herself alone. So who wants to come, who wants to associate with a whore? Really, she was left alone with no protection. This is when the association with, okay, so I need a protector. I need someone who will keep an eye on me. Well, and Guilford is very interesting that way. You know, I catch that sentence, this historical moment, so important because these situations have isolated back then, has isolated women to the point where, what do you want me to do? You know, I need a and this is why soldiers and were such good companions.
Yeah, I mean, they're perfect.
They're perfect companions.
The book talks really interestingly about the sort of like the co-location of sex workers and soldiers in Montreal's past. And I really like that. I really enjoyed that because I remember reading Wolkowitz years ago about the Victorian prostitution. And one of the kind of the sort of vignettes she uses is a woman whose main clientele was soldiers. She liked soldiers. And why wouldn't you? Because it would be like people of your own class, wouldn't it? You know, and that's the thing, isn't it? It's that kind of, when you get to that debate around pimp, yeah? I mean, it's we never really talk about this absolute sort of like two-pronged attack on the non-deserving poor, the poor that want to do something about their poverty but don't want to come through the middle classes to do it, you know? So what do? You get women that are sort of like operating outside the system. You don't just criminalize them, but you criminalize the men that they associate.
Oh, of course, yes.
I mean, you know, in the UK law, you can get 7 years incarceration if you live off the earnings of a woman who's engaged in prostitution. But I mean, that could mean her paying the rent, know, with no violence, no coercion or anything. So it's an undermining of a sort of like working class subculture, I think, that we don't really ever talk about, you know. So, I've thoroughly enjoyed reading your book. You know, I've really enjoyed reading your book. You said previously that you didn't write it for an academic audience. Who did you write it for then?
I wrote it because I just want people to actually read it and rethink. Just can we have a real conversation? Can we have a dialogue? First of all, on just this reputation. Okay, the pilot project was ruined in part. It was like, if you read, and of course I had the excerpt, you know, at length in the dissertation. If you listen to people in the neighborhood, close your eyes, and we are in the 1800s.
Yeah.
Nothing, Rachel, nothing has moved.
Yeah.
Nothing, not a single symbol, not a single thought differs.
No, it's stationary, isn't it? It's stationary.
And of course, Stella is very dishonest by not telling the truth that women are abused, drug addicts, involved in criminal activity with organized crime. And they're trying to make believe, to deceive. They're deceiving people by the government is actually giving subsidized grants to organizations that encourage this kind of relationship, between organized crime and women. And they're not sex workers, by the way. They're only these poor women that are abused, exploited by criminals.
Yeah. And just to clarify, this was the argument against Stella, Stella was
this
being...
is the argument against Stella that came out in writing in newspaper at the time. In newspapers at the time, I have quote verbatim.
Yeah.
Actually saying a lot better than what I just said now.
Yeah. So what's Stella doing now? What's happening with Stella?
Right now, I think first of all, I think I would have to refer you to Jen Clayman. But right now, I think they're organizing again for another campaign to decriminalize, to change the laws. So okay. That's the only thing I know for now, because I didn't even have the time to read the latest newsletter that came from Stella. As a matter of fact, I will definitely ask Jen, to have the latest news. But the last I heard is that there's another campaign, and it's the Coalition Sex Workers Coalition. Canadian coalition, and I think Stella is member of this coalition, and they're doing campaigning to have the law change one more time.
Well, if it helps, I had a report released yesterday that I've done for the Doctors of the World about the impact of withdrawing services from just a health-based service and giving them to an exiting service, and the impacts that this has had on women's health and women's safety before and after the COVID period. And for the listeners, I will put that in the blog as well, so people can have a look at that. Francine, it's been amazing to talk to you. What have you got planned next?
What am I planning next? Oh, my God. Like I said, most probably something on, I think marginalized woman, basically going back on the identity, marginalized, criminalized identity. I have to give it a bit more thought. I definitely want to take the time to read a bit more about what Stella doing right now, and of course I will be involved in activism, writing either letter or with students are very active right now in terms of decriminalization of sex work. They really are trying to do their part on it.
Yeah, bless them. So that's the end of our podcast. I was speaking to Francine Tremblay about her amazing book, Organizing Sex Work and Rights in Montreal, but we seem to have talked about everything else as well, which is an awesome pleasure. My name is Rachel Stewart. I'm a PhD researcher at the University of Kent. And this is a podcast for the New Book Network under the channel Sex, Sex Work and Sexuality. Thank you so much for listening.